all along the Mississippi River. But really, there are a series of these lobes that in some ways sort of parallel the river and then track back to sort of drainages that are in the uplands. And then there are these gaps between the levees, which we'll be passing over a little bit on Monday. And those gaps in some ways are these shunts or upland flood events to bring water as quickly as they can to the river. Where flooding usually occurs in this area is not along these 500-foot levees that parallel the river. They're usually in the middle of the floodplain. And when I say the floodplain here, we're talking about an area that's about 4 miles wide. One of the widest floodplains in the upper Mississippi Basin. It's really well defined. We'll be ending Monday inside of the limestone bluffs that define the floodplain. But where the flooding occurs usually here is in the space between the river and the bluffs, when you have systemic flooding that's matched with localized flooding, and that's where most of the breaches end up happening. So in the part, I wanted to sort of bring us here along these large levees just to sort of understand a little bit more and to loop around a bit of the discussion that we were having yesterday and that Derek's drawings were drawing. Before I moved on to this,
something that we always get hung up and we got on yesterday with the visibility of flooding. Mm. But there's the other extreme, which is drought.
Right.
And lack of water, which is even somewhat more of a larger problem in the American bottom than flooding is, because the groundwater supply gets contaminated at that point. I don't know exactly how it works, but when the levels of the river are way, way down, it becomes a different condition of how you're getting your water.
Right.
So we also, the absence we were talking about earlier, the lack of water, it does exist in, strangely, a place that you would think would be so full of water.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, if you stand on the levee like this, there is a wet side and a dry side, right? There's a side that's allowed to flood, and then there's a side that is supposedly protected from floods. I've always thought that these areas between the levee and the river, between the levee and the regular river channel, we call them thatcher lands, you can really imagine things a little bit differently there, right? You can't get crop insurance there. There's a number of sort of like administrative constraints that exist in this interval between the levee and the river. In the discussion that we ended on law, that was my real question. It had to do with like how that reconciliation between water law and property law sort of, hit the ground, and it's really right here where that happens. So there are a number of these administrative constraints, easements, etc., that exists in here. Please, yeah.
I was just gonna say, why does that not then make it more conducive to return to a more wetland environment? If it's no insurance is possible, if it's not part of like a secure agricultural production.
Right. I mean, if there are projects for this to happen, they are, digging secondary channels in that thatcherland. But the truth is that, the sort of wetland restoration projects that are stable and that are, relatively, they have a kind of duration associated with them, they get scrubbed away so fast by the floods. Like, the flood events that happen here totally destabilize everything over on this side of the river.
More in the pooled section, the upper reaches, that's where the core is doing more of their, and it's much more manageable.
Yeah, that 50-foot tidal, that 50-foot flood level, right, is measured here at this point 2 or 3 times a year. If you see on the large, we call it the colorful mound, but it's a Job pile. It's a tailings of the washing of the. Yeah. It's about this height, and you can sort of see that most recent scar along the bottom edge.
Just from this past March. May.
That's the second highest.
The water was up to about here.
Yeah.
So Jesse, would you need the whole floodplain volumetrically for that to be significant, or is there that much more water entering the system from agricultural flooding that even this floodplain isn't adequate to,
do you mean to like,
deal
just
with
like
the
actually
large flood events?
Hold the volume of water that a flood event would occur?
Yeah, to kind of absorb the potential damages of a big flood event.
Oh, goodness. The existence of Horseshoe Lake serves as a really big sink, and it always has, in this area. But I think that, like, the volatility of the Mississippi River, like, cannot be unimagined. You have to really, it's such a volatile river. So on the one hand, we're here to sort of like talk about the levee, the river management, the sort of like height of the flood level. And it was Jen, right? I mean, Jennifer Colton is one of the collaborators amongst the team. And Jennifer comes to this site, what, 3 times a week?
Well, that's a slight exaggeration, but it's 3 times a year. So I have not been here for a little bit. Well, we were here recently, but March, when the flooding started, June, it was inaccessible. So as the water has receded back, I have been down a few times. It's very wild in there. I've seen coyotes. I've seen lots of deer, of course. And I've even seen a couple of bobcats. So it's a wild place. Exciting. It's a little bit scary, just as a to be walking around, but it's actually, in a very strange way, also very peaceful. I mean, with all of the changes that happen seasonally and yearly, you can imagine the vegetation is constantly changing. Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer's photographs are this like sort of silent witness to all of those changes. I mean, it's been years and years now that you've been coming.
Yeah. I mean, the space is both changing all the time, and also there are things that are very familiar. So, it's part of an investigation of the ecology and of just of artistic practice that's going back in there, literally in there. And by the way, the river is quite close. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could really probably throw a stone if you're really good. You can get it to the river. Very close. But the practice of going back and investigating all of those changes and all of the things that stay the same is fascinating.
Jen, you know what that looks
like? I don't know what that is. So some of the stories that have been told to me back in the day, the 60s, and the old timers used to play, go up there, climb up there, and it was their play. This heap was their playground. We've seen photographs of this mound. We've seen aerial photographs that map how far back, 80 years, and this mound exists in those photographs. So this has been around for a long time.
Yeah, it's basically from about 1917 to 1950 is the so the heap that Jennifer's talking about. This is a Job pile. It's a coal tip. It's the residue from the washing of the coal. And so one of the main reasons I wanted to come here is that I think a lot of these mound sites, and as well as a lot of these landscapes, they also point to other landscapes. They make us account for the kinds of extractive industries that are happening outside of our field of view, right? And so we can sit here and we can look at the mound site, and it is a truly incredible sort of artifact to witness change over time, etc. But really, for me, this begins to invoke the pits that are, maybe what, 50 miles from here, right? So for every one of these pits. So for every one of the piles, there's a pit, right? For every mound, there's a borrow pit somewhere. I think that this is one of those landscapes that makes us, if you're like attentive to the ways that it might mean, right? And that has to do with the significant and insignificant mounds project. That it really does begin to sort of like call our attention to that unbuilding of the earth itself.
I'm thinking of form. Does it have to be earth? Does it have to be mass? Cut and fill to be defined as what you guys are defining as?
I mean, for me, I'll just say that there is something really important about the sort of, the muteness, the density, the potential, dumbness of earth.
Yes,
of the actual weight of that itself. It's, so while in some ways it does sort of barter in the sort of misreading of form, it's not, doesn't go quite that far. Like, to go that far would sort of, for me, lose the tension between, in the misreading of them, yep, across one another. Yeah. So it certainly doesn't, it's not about shape, I would say.
Is this one?
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah, I feel that, I feel that.
I would add something else, too. You know, when we're thinking about these mounds, we're also, and we talked about it earlier, we're thinking about the erasure of the mounds as well, so the residue and the sense, like the feeling, bodily sense, that remains even once the mound is no longer there is something that I think is really real and present. So, you know, in a way, it doesn't necessitate the seeing of the earth. The sensing of the space of the mound earth is also important. I think that's something true, real.
There's something about the distance in the economy and the metabolism of the mound, right? There's a certain, like, really close proximity between the sort of material of extraction and then the thing itself,
and
right?
Earth,
and that proximity, like, it gets a little bit lost in the processing, right? But I think that, like, you know, it, like, what it does allow us to talk about are some of the pit heads, right? They are some of the sort of other points of extraction. Like those, for example, share a lot more commonality with this thing than that would, even though that's shit, right? And so, you know, but I think that, like, that sort of, like, metabolic closeness and the, you know, the earthen of sort of economy of sort of, like, extractions and then displacement and replacement. I don't know, there's something in that short distance that makes this, for me, like a sort of, like, ongoing, compelling sort of question.
There's something weird about it, actually, though, because I'm thinking if it was, when was it put up? You don't know.
1917 to 1942.
When it starts to appear. So why, how are they doing it? Like, how are they piling it up so high? Like, why aren't they just spreading it out? Like, it doesn't make any sense. What are they doing?
I
want
to know more.
It might have been
containing it.
Huh?
You know, by piling it on top of each other, it kept from spreading it around, knowing that.
Well,
and so then how are they getting it up the hill?
Okay, but this is also so important because, like, right now we're sitting in what feels like a sort of, like, empty landscape, right?
But exactly, this, like, why did they just spread it around?
No, but it looks like an empty landscape now, but at the time it was full of rail, full of railroad tracks. And so the Southern Coal and Coke company that owned this, that was extracting the coal and washing it here, they didn't have this territory that we see right now, right? And so, I mean, this entire area is... you know, if you look at an early rail map, you know, I mean, like, Eastern Capital just, like, raced to the Mississippi River right here. And basically, like, there's an entire flank from East Carondelet all the way up past North St. Louis that is essentially constant rail. And that was there in advance of the sort of cities that were built here. That's why we got lost coming here on Route 3, is because they had to sort of, you know, they had to weave roads and cities and houses and things through that rail system that had already raced across the floodplains, had extracted the existing mounds that were already here to lay the beds in the floodplain, and then they get here and they're making more mounds, right? So what we're seeing right now is a sort of, you know, it's a residue of a sort of post-industrial emptiness, but actually this was, like, an intensely dense and full site of rail and other kinds of industry. So they just didn't have the acreage.
But how about the process? Today, when they wash coal, they build giant impoundments. They wash the coal with a huge amount of water, which they pump into these impoundments where it settles and it becomes a mountain.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Here, what did they do? They just wash it directly in the river?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like, so you had tremendous black streams, rivers going into the Mississippi?
Absolutely. You had a black stream going into the Mississippi, and you had a black smoke cloud that made St. Louis, like, the most polluted city in the 30s. Wow. I mean, like, you know, they talk like this. Again, made to burn that really soft coal of the Illinois coal field. And, you know, the photographs or the sort of accounts of the, you know, sort of like the midsummer nights. The midday nights of St. Louis that were basically caused from this and then one other, I think it's Labadie. One of the other coal-fired plants up the road.
So they would have had here maybe some kind of a spout with coal going through it, water pouring on it, and this was just the residue.
This is just the heavy residue of, some of it's clinker, you know, from sort of like, you know, more recent brick, sort of a pile begets other piles, right? And so, you know, once you have a pile, people start to make other piles around that. But really, you know, it's the shale, the other things that were sort of like in the coal when they were extracting it. But yeah, there's stories of just like, you know, whether it's, you know, that black river that you were talking about from here was then met with the sort of muddy, fatty river of the slaughterhouses. And so I mean, like, you know, St. Louis at this time was a real cocktail of a river right here. Yeah.
Different aromas than we're having.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So how many are going down, all the way down, going to New Orleans?
You mean like being in New Orleans or going all the way down?
Just awesome. Being there and then like later, yeah. Because New Orleans, I love New Orleans. I place I go there a lot. But there's a lot of people in New Orleens don't know that this exists. Mm. They don't know there's 500 year levees of this scale up here that these are as big as the ones in the 20s in New Orleens, right? So as you take this down river and the work happens down there, the American Bottom, you may know this, but it might be a rumor, is the second largest populated flood protected area in America after New Orleans. Right, so when we talk about things like in New Orleans, like the Lower Nine and those places that got hit hard, this got hit hard.
Right.
You're taking all of this stuff with you down there. Yeah. So just know, like, this is good information to bring down with you when we have the workshop in New Orleans, right? Especially the American Bottom.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's still a switch. I mean, there's the new, larger natural gas fired plants that are up north, a little bit further, they recently turned, just last year, maybe 2 years ago, the Alton plant, which is also a coal-fired plant, went offline for a bit. Maybe 2 years. It was still,
There's a coal handling facility here, though.
Oh, yeah.
They still, I mean, it retains the traces of its logistical past, right? I mean, like, coal is still coming in, and, you know, we're going to go through it tomorrow, but Granite Steel, the Pittsburgh of the West, is right up this way, and so it's still a coal handling plant. Not so much soft Illinois coal, but other coal coming from, you know, sort of like other sites down the Ohio or, from out west. But, you know, they had the facilities here. I mean, Jen and Matt have stories about when that went offline, they filled it halfway full of earth in order to sort of like, you know, like all of the sort of like the big pits that sort of like, you know, rendered the turbines and everything workable. I don't know the details of how this would work, but they filled it with earth. Like, it's basically all that is entombed in order for them to sort of facilitate trucks driving into what was otherwise a big pit to sort of get an offload coal. Is that true?
Yep, that's true.
We're already running a little late. I could stay here for forever and ever. But I do think we should probably start to head back, make our way to Cahokia for the final stop of the day, and our final ascent.
Okay.
It's